We've been following up this week on the story of a computer bug that attacked Iran. The Stuxnet virus partially disabled a nuclear plant, and though nobody has taken credit, it's suspected the United States may have played a role.
So it's ironic that Stuxnet could provide a blueprint for cyber attacks against the United States. Power plant operators are preparing for the worst.
This is not a good thing. Our screens are black, lights are out, we're flying blind.
That was a training exercise. The big fear for the Department of Homeland Security and others is what happens in a real attack. Today, NPR's Tom Gelton considers what Stuxnet tells us about the dilemmas of cyber war.
This story begins back in 2007. That spring, researchers at the Energy Department's Idaho National Laboratory carried out an important experiment. They'd been looking at the computers that run the equipment at power plants and other critical facilities, and they wondered if someone could hack into those systems and somehow destroy the equipment, the turbines, the pumps, the pipelines. So they hauled a big diesel generator into the lab. It was a $1 million guinea pig.
I saw a fine piece of machinery. It was spring-mounted. It had a flexible coupling.
Michael Asante was one of the researchers. The experiment was called Project Aurora. Asante and the others hooked the generator up to the computer, just as it would be in real life, and then they messed with the instructions that the computer was sending to the generator. Until then, computer bugs were seen as more of an annoyance than anything else, but the Idaho researchers were able to rewrite the code so that the computer told the big generator to blow itself up, which it did.
When we started to conduct the test, that really robust machine couldn't take it. The coupling broke between the prime mover and the generator. You saw the actual machine itself belching smoke coming out of it.
The test was initially kept secret, but video of the generator coming apart was soon leaked and broadcast on CNN. From that point on, Asante says, the cyber risk to power plants and other facilities had to be taken more seriously. Project Aurora demonstrated the cyber threat in vivid terms.
It's very vivid when something shakes apart and you see black smoke bulging out of it and doesn't do what it's supposed to do. It's very vivid when something breaks apart in a fireball.
About 2 years after the Aurora experiment, someone introduced a bug into a computer that controlled some of the centrifuges at a uranium enrichment facility in Iran, Stuxnet. And what happened? The centrifuges broke, just like the diesel generator at the Idaho lab. The fact that U.S. researchers in 2007 already knew how to destroy equipment through a cyber attack has prompted some people to think the United States maybe developed the Stuxnet worm. There's also the sophistication of the worm. Ralph Langner, one of the first cyber researchers to study Stuxnet, says he was impressed by the malicious software, the malware, used in the Stuxnet cyber weapon.
To us, it was pretty clear in the early phase of our analysis that the development of this particular malware required resources that we do only see in the United States.
Others dispute that. Marty Edwards from the Department of Homeland Security runs the Cyber Emergency Response Team at the Idaho Lab. He says that by the time Stuxnet came along, engineers around the world had already figured out that the computers used in industrial control systems were vulnerable in similar ways.
The vulnerabilities discovered in those systems all have common threads or common traits. And so I think it was only a matter of time before those common weaknesses or vulnerabilities were leveraged in an event such as Stuxnet. So I don't think anybody was particularly surprised when that happened.
We may never know whether the U.S. government had a role in creating the Stuxnet cyber weapon, but we do know this. The necessary knowledge and expertise was apparently there. The use of Stuxnet against Iran would have been consistent with U.S. policy, which has favored the sabotage of Iranian nuclear facilities. And finally, we know the United States does have some kind of offensive capability in the cyber war domain. We can attack. We just don't know much about that capability. Herbert Lin, chief scientist at the National Academy of Sciences, edited an unclassified report on policy, law, and ethics in cyber war. He says one possible reason for the silence on offensive cyber weapons is that they're still in development. Or maybe the government still hasn't figured out what U.S. policy should be in this area.
We're still trying to get our heads around whether we really want to have a world in which offensive capabilities play a big role. Some people might say yes, some people might say no, and we don't really know what we want, so we're silent about it.
The use of cyber weapons by the United States or anyone would pose a dilemma because of what security experts call the blowback risk, the idea that a weapon meant to be used against your enemy might be turned back against you. In such cases, you need a risk-benefit analysis of the cyber war option. The conclusion of such an analysis may not be obvious. The Project Aurora researcher, Michael Asante, was among the first cybersecurity experts to warn that Stuxnet could provide a blueprint for attacks on U.S. infrastructure. But meeting with reporters recently at the Idaho lab, Asante chose to emphasize the context in which Stuxnet was apparently developed, the fear that Iran might develop a nuclear weapon.
That's probably one of the largest national security challenges I can envision, personally. So in that context, I'll bet you can make a pretty strong argument that the benefit of using a cyber weapon to slow down or delay or to achieve a specific objective might absolutely outweigh the risk.
But who gets to weigh the benefits against the risks? That's a pretty big responsibility. And here's another question. If the U.S. government develops a cyber weapon that could eventually be turned against us, should the people responsible for defending the country against cyber attacks be told about it? A former intelligence official tells NPR that if the National Security Agency or the CIA did develop a cyber weapon, it would probably be so top secret that not even the Department of Homeland Security would know about it. Herbert Lin of the National Academy of Sciences says the question of information sharing between the offensive and defensive teams is a hot issue right now in cyber circles.
My sense is that there are lots of people talking about it, but most of the discussion, almost all of the discussion, is going on behind closed doors.
Eventually, this could change. Whether and when the United States should use nuclear weapons or chemical weapons or landmines has been vigorously debated in public for years. And it's probably only a matter of time before we can also discuss the risks and benefits of using a cyber weapon, like Stuxnet, for example. Tom Gelton, NPR News.
The U.S. has long been reluctant to point fingers at the countries most likely to steal its business ideas and technology. But a report released today does just that. It's called Foreign Spies Stealing U.S. Economic Secrets in Cyberspace. The U.S. agency responsible for counterintelligence says China is the world's leading source of economic espionage. And number two, it's Russia. NPR's Tom Gelton has our story.
U.S. officials have long complained privately that China and Russia are out to steal U.S. trade secrets, intellectual property, and high technology. But in public, they refer obliquely to some nations or our rivals. Until today, when the National Counterintelligence Executive, Robert Bryant, stood at a podium and did not mince words.
China and Russia, through their intelligence services and through their corporations, are attacking our research and development.
Bryant's report to Congress was explicit. Chinese actors are the world's most active and persistent perpetrators of economic espionage. Russia's intelligence services are conducting a range of activities to collect economic information and technology from the U.S. This theft, according to the report, is eroding the U.S. global economic advantage, which has long been based on technological innovation. China and Russia are singled out in the report because, in the words of a senior intelligence official, we have to say who we consider the foreign intelligence services and countries that are doing the most harm to our status. Music to the ears of Alan Paller, research director of the SANS Institute, which does cybersecurity training. He spoke today at the presentation of the espionage report, noting how U.S. officials usually only hint that China and Russia are stealing U.S. secrets.
But no one ever says it. So what's magical about this is somebody got up and said what everyone knew.
Robert Bryant's predecessor as the nation's counterintelligence executive, Joel Brenner, says previous efforts to highlight what China was doing, for example, were impeded by diplomatic sensitivities or sometimes just by intelligence community culture.
The tendency in top secret agencies just not to want to be candid. I mean, it's the habit. You know, it's an understandable habit. There's lots of things that you can't talk about when you're on the inside. But when you get to the point where the only people who aren't being told the truth is the American public, then it becomes silly.
Presenting his report today, Robert Bryant said no one knows the total cost to U.S. companies from the theft of U.S. research and development secrets.
All we know is that the losses are extremely significant and they're extremely harmful to our national well-being.
U.S. intelligence officials say Chinese leaders believe the next decade gives them a chance to catch up to the West. To do that, they need Western technology because they don't have the same tradition of innovation that the U.S. has. They can demand that foreign companies that want to do business in China must first share their technology, or the Chinese can simply steal it, largely through cyber means. In the case of Russia, the intelligence report quotes President Vladimir Putin as saying the Russian intelligence service should more actively protect the economic interests of our companies abroad. Joel Brenner, who has a new book titled America the Vulnerable, points out that U.S. technology is what drives the American economy.
When we lose that technology, the ultimate result is that somebody in a foreign country is opening a factory and hiring workers, and somebody in the United States is closing a factory or laying off or not hiring workers. And so this is not just a problem for the military and the State Department and for the owners of companies. It's a problem for the country. We are being slowly hollowed out.
Among the sectors China, Russia, and other countries are said to be targeting, pharmaceuticals, aeronautics, and advanced manufacturing techniques, all areas where the U.S. until now has had a competitive advantage. Tom Gelton, NPR News, Washington.
Around the country, police are being accused of excessive force in dealing with Occupy Wall Street protests. That's the case in Oakland, California, where a protester was seriously injured, allegedly by a police tear gas canister. These types of complaints are nothing new, but now a growing number of police are arming themselves with technology to document their side of the story. NPR's Martin Costi reports some officers are now wearing mini video cameras, something that's creating thorny new disputes.
Hispanic male got a black shirt, blue jeans, standing in the front yard. He's got two machetes in his hands.
You've seen police videos, but maybe not quite from this angle. In this footage, recorded in Texas, you see the suspect from the point of view of the officer holding the gun.
Put it down. I do not want to shoot you, man. Put it down.
No one got shot in that scene, just tasered. This recording is on the website of VView, one of a handful of companies now making wearable cameras for cops. VView's $900 device looks like a clip-on pager. Officer Ben Sias tested it for the Bainbridge Island Police Department in Washington State.
It's mounted either in the car or I can wear it on my uniform. And normally when I would go on a traffic stop or make a contact, I would flip it on. And the only thing that really was different as far as doing business would be that I'd tell the person that we were being recorded.
Most of the time, Sias says, people don't even seem to register the presence of the camera. They have other things on their minds. Sias sees the cameras as a kind of insurance.
In this job, we're frequently accused of things that we haven't done or things that are kind of embellished. Sometimes people's perception or what they report may not be what happened, and the cameras show a pretty unbiased opinion of what actually did happen.
That's the hope, anyway. On the other side of Puget Sound, the Seattle Police Department is looking for ways to handle the fallout from other people's videos. For instance, this one last year showing a Seattle cop punching a teenage girl.
Are you serious?
Seattle City Council member Bruce Harrell says images like this have undermined community confidence in Seattle police.
What we have now are videos after the fact, you know, the second punch kind of situation.
So Harrell is pushing for Seattle police to wear cameras too. He wants a more complete view of some of these controversial encounters between police and the public, and he's also hoping to get a calming effect from the camera's very presence.
People behave differently when they are on camera. I'm behaving differently because you have a microphone in front of my face. That's what human beings do, both the public and the officers. So these cameras, I believe, can restore trust.
Harrell's enthusiasm is not shared by Sergeant Rich O'Neill, president of the Seattle Police Officers Guild. He doesn't like the fact that many of the departments that have adopted the wearable cameras have given their officers little discretion. They're required to record every contact with the public, and they can't stop recording until it's over, even if a citizen asks them to. Sergeant O'Neill says people should think hard about what it'll mean to have police officers show up at the front door with a camera rolling.
Now I'm bringing the camera into your home, and maybe I'm there for something as small as a noise complaint. Maybe I'm at your home for something much more serious. Maybe it's a terribly traumatic event, domestic violence victim, a child abuse victim, and I'm going to be walking in that home videotaping.
Of course, in public, there's no escaping cameras anymore. This is YouTube video of the mayhem that broke out recently between Occupy protesters and police in Oakland, California. Some of it was posted with running commentary.
But if you doubt that the police were deliberately aiming at the protesters, watch this policeman.
It can get pretty forensic.
Watch that again.
What these YouTube sleuths may not realize is the fact that Oakland police are equipped with wearable cameras, so they may very well have a recording of their perspective on that very same scene. If they do, you won't be seeing it on TV anytime soon. Oakland doesn't release police footage that's part of an active investigation. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, says Rocky Lucia.
Facts don't come out on a 30-second YouTube video.
Lucia is the lawyer for the Police Officers Association in Oakland. Departments generally negotiate with their police unions before they adopt the cameras, and the unions push for rules that limit access. For instance, police don't want supervisors trolling through the videos looking for infractions. At the same time, officers also want access to their own tapes. In Oakland, Lucia has made sure that cops get to see their own recordings before writing reports or making official statements.
There's going to be inconsistencies. It's our job as the union or the association representing the police officers to make sure that the officer isn't held accountable for inconsistencies that could lead one to believe that the officer is not being truthful.
But some people worry about the opposite problem, that the only ones with easy access to the videos will be the authorities.
My name is Eric Rackner, and we're standing at the corner where 3 years ago last week the Seattle police arrested me illegally.
The reason for Rackner's arrest doesn't really matter here. Suffice it to say that it had something to do with a sidewalk game of something called Nerf golf. What's significant here is that Rackner believed he'd be exonerated by police videos, footage from dashboard cameras in this case. But when he tried to get the videos, the city dragged its feet for months. He says for a while, the city wouldn't even acknowledge that some of the videos existed.
They really just don't want to give it out unless it is just a clear-cut example of something that supports what the officer said or tends to show that the arrestee is guilty.
Rackner eventually received a $60,000 public disclosure judgment. He also demanded and got a log of all Seattle police videos shot in the last 3 years, and he's now posted that on a searchable website to make it easier for people to find out if police have recordings of them. He plans to keep updating the site, and if Seattle cops start wearing cameras, those videos should be searchable too.
Events that occur in public and are recorded, especially in the course of a public officer doing his public duty, that's fair game.
Police videos are generally considered public records, but in practice, departments are giving new reasons not to release them. For instance, Oakland is now withholding some footage on privacy grounds. Still, public interest in those recordings is likely to intensify as wearable cameras capture more and more of what police officers see every day. Martin Costi, NPR News, Seattle.
Now, for the occupiers, it may be all about the Benjamins. But what happens when you use real money to buy imaginary things? It's happening every day on Facebook. People are paying to buy things for pretend farms and cities, thanks to Zynga, a virtual goods company. This industry took in $9 billion real dollars last year alone from consumers buying tractors and buildings that don't exist. Now Zynga is going public with an IPO expected in the next few weeks, and Zynga is trying hard to get ahead of the game by dropping millions of dollars on a few new games, including Castleville. NPR's Arthi Shahani set off to understand the market value of a business built on nothing.
We'll start with the tour of Piskorskyville. It's a bustling city full of stores, row houses, and red brick condos. A policeman patrols downtown, waving his baton. Northeast, there's a small community garden.
I forgot to come back to my city, so some of my plants have withered away, and my friends actually have been kind enough to come back and unwither some of my plants.
That's Meshek Piskorsky, the city's namesake. But city is a slight misnomer. Piskorskyville doesn't really exist. Or one could say it totally does, on his computer screen. Meshek is sitting in his office at Harvard Business School. He's a professor. His job? To play and study popular online games like Cityville by Zynga. Meshek harvests his virtual crop and sells to a local grocer. Not for cash, at least not the green folding type. His money, like his goods, are virtual. But for 5% of Zynga's 200 million monthly users, that's not the case.
You can buy a special currency, and you can use it in two ways. You can spend it on speeding up certain processes or getting some functionalities that are available to you that are not available to others. But you can also spend the currency on beautifying the city.
Luxury condos, yachts, they won't have a use.
But they will be just really beautiful to look at.
Zynga raked in $1 billion in sales this last year. That's $1 billion U.S. dollars, the green folding type. In sales of virtual tractors that plow virtual farms, or avatars that make gamers just a bit more beautiful to look at. 19-year-old Tiara Kate sells Zynga currency at a CVS in Washington, D.C. She points to a shelf lined with prepaid cards, Starbucks, Lowe's Theater, and one with a goofy duck waddling up a pasture. That's for Farmville, Zynga's mega hit.
I've seen kids come in with their parents and cry for these cards, or older people, like between late 30, early 40, a lot of them buy the Farmville cards.
Why are you laughing? Why is it funny?
Because my dad does it too, and I think it's like ridiculous. I think it's, say it's a $20 gift card. When it's gone, you'll be buying another one.
That's exactly the point. Traditional video games make you pay up front. Zynga inverted the model. Play for free, and once you're hooked, pay to get ahead. Zynga officials declined an interview because, they said, they're in a quiet period required by the Securities and Exchange Commission before the IPO. Eric Ries, author of the New York Times bestseller, The Lean Startup, is a Zynga fan. Or, to be more precise, a critic of the critics. To those who say virtual goods aren't real,
I don't think that you're using the word real correctly. What is real?
Fashionistas spend $2,000 on a Prada handbag. Gamers spend $20 on an imaginary tractor or avatar or sword. Same difference, except...
Unlike in the physical world, the virtual objects are all tied to the specific environment in which they were developed. So if you have a sword in a game like World of Warcraft, you can't take that sword with you into the real world, but you also can't take it with you into other games.
The Zynga IPO is a test of whether this new thing, the virtual good, is durable.
Maybe just it's a fad.
That's Sam Hamada, CEO of Privco. He sifts through the financial data of private corporations. He estimates Zynga is worth $5 billion. Others say $20 billion. Ironically, it comes down to whether competitors buy into the business model.
Now that they've shown the way, the question is, will traditional gaming companies like Electronic Arts, like Activision, you know, will Disney then start offering games based on its characters in the same model?
Zynga broke the curse of online businesses. It kicked the addiction to ad revenue, the bane of the web. The ads it does have enhanced the game. American Express sponsors blue virtual windmills that help grow crops. Lady Gaga sexed up the scene by releasing her album Born This Way on Gagaville. Zynga's IPO will now test whether the company's modern-day alchemy, turning virtual goods into real money, is a game-changer for the gaming industry. Arthi Shahani, NPR News.
Wagner's Ring Cycle has been a staple of opera repertoire for nearly a century and a half. This is a recording from the Metropolitan Opera a few years ago. This season, the company is giving the work a 21st century makeover with a new production of Siegfried, the third opera in the cycle. The staging features 3D-like special effects, computerized projections that create spooky optical illusions of forests alive with creeping, flying fauna. But it turns out these special effects are just the latest technological leap in the Opera House. Engineer, opera buff, and media historian Mark Shubin has traced these advances going back to the 19th century and joins me now from our New York bureau. Mark Shubin, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
And of course, you are also an Emmy award-winning engineer for the Metropolitan Opera in New York. So maybe you can explain to me how exactly is a live performance, how does that involve 3D? Is that a misnomer?
Well, in this case, 3D probably is a misnomer, but I should point out that there have been operas that were performed live that did have true 3D with the audience wearing glasses. You're familiar with those pictures of movie audiences all wearing their 3D glasses. Well, there's a picture that shows an audience that looks a little classier than a movie audience, and that was actually taken at the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion during the performance of Monsters of Grace, which was a Philip Glass opera that had a true three-dimensional backdrop.
That's just one example of a sort of a modern media innovation, and I'm saying modern by opera standards. Can you list maybe two or three others, just straight examples of things that opera tried out before they became widespread, or in some cases, before they were technically invented?
Sure. Well, we're listening to radio right now. The first radio transmission of a complete opera was in 1910. That's 10 years before what some people consider the first radio station. Even before that, there were people who were listening to opera at home via telephone lines, using headphones, and in some cases in stereo sound. It all began with an invalid in New York, a guy by the name of Edward Fry, who had been an opera impresario and in his later life was stuck in bed. So he had telephone lines installed to the local opera house, the Academy of Music, and they came to his house and he could hold up the telephone receiver and listen to the opera, and that was in 1880.
You also say at one point that I guess the idea of a pay monthly service essentially started with opera?
That's correct. There was pay cable beginning in 1885 for opera. It was in Lisbon. That one was an annual fee. You paid the equivalent of about $1,800 today to get the entire opera season of 90 operas. There was also stereo transmission in Paris. You could go to a train station or a hotel lobby, put in your coin, and listen to 3 minutes of opera. And there was a home service that had an annual fee for the lines, and then it was pay per event. But there was another service that started in Budapest in 1893, and that was a monthly subscription service. And for that one, the guy knew that the operas were going to start at 8 p.m., and he had these lines going to the homes, and he figured, how can I maximize the use of these lines? And so he invented something that your listeners are very familiar with, the newscast. And the first newscast was in 1893, created to use the lines that were put in for the delivery of opera.
Newscast meaning they actually delivered a little bit of news before the show, or you mean the act of the broadcasting?
No, he actually had people that he called stentors, and they would read the news into the microphone. They would do it before the opera and during the intermission. It's the progenitor of NPR, if you will.
And I'm going to start using stentors because that is an awesome name for what we do. We have a clip from a 1908 film, and this is the voice, at least, of the opera singer Enrico Caruso. La donna mobile, qual piuma al vento, fluta da cerco di pensiero. Mark Shubin, what can you tell us about this film?
Well, that's sort of the origin of the Milli Vanilli scandal. It's the the beginning of lip syncing.
So it's Caruso's voice, but
Caruso's
we're not
voice.
Looking at him.
Right. It was a manufacturer of a movie sound system. This one was called the Cinephone, and he wanted to promote his sound system, so he hired an actor to lip sync to Caruso.
How do you think that opera is influencing the modern media world in this century?
Well, you mentioned at the beginning this so-called 3D projection system that's being used in Siegfried. It's some of the most advanced technology imaginable. And there are people who work on rock concerts, who work in all sorts of other levels of computer graphics and projection, who are calling the people at the Met every day and saying, oh, what'd you do today? What'd you do today? Because it's just so amazing how they're pushing the limits.
Mark Shubin, he's an Emmy Award-winning engineer with the Metropolitan Opera in New York. He joined us from our New York bureau. Mark Shubin, thank you for talking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You can see video of the new 3D production of Siegfried from the Metropolitan Opera at nprmusic.org. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Audie Cornish.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Guy Raz.
And I'm Robert Siegel. And it's time now for All Tech Considered. Today, a look at social media and the CIA. A group within the agency monitors Facebook updates and tweets from people overseas, up to 5 million a day. Kimberly Dozier got a rare inside look at these operations. She is the intelligence correspondent for the Associated Press, and she joins me in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you.
What exactly is the CIA looking at?
This is the Open Source Center. They're looking at anything that you can find openly, not covertly, not by spying. This is everything from a newspaper article in Russia to a radio broadcast in Bangkok to what someone is tweeting near Abbottabad, Pakistan, as a Navy SEAL raid is happening. It's anything that you or I could also find, except the top minds at the CIA are looking at this stuff and they're sending it to the White House and beyond.
How many minds are actually looking at this? Because we're talking about a mountainous amount of information here.
You're talking about several hundred staffers. You've got people who are experts at finding information. A lot of them have masters of librarian science. They know how to track things down on the internet that you and I simply wouldn't know existed. They also try to hire people who are native language speakers of another language. This is the way that the CIA is trying to give policymakers back in the States an idea of what next step should they take. What might be the reaction or the fallout on the ground?
The intended people being listened to or read here are foreigners overseas. Should we assume, though, that if Americans are tweeting in South Asia, that they're going to be intercepted along with everyone else?
Well, if that's part of the language that's being followed and they happen to be there, I guess it could be swept up in the analysis. But the CIA was very clear with me, we do not follow Americans here or overseas. That's not our purview.
And what are the successes that the CIA has claimed from doing this?
Well, they have predicted things like, believe it or not, the fallout from the revolt in Egypt, the Arab Spring. I sat down with the director of the center, Doug Nakhwan, who said that after the Twitter revolution of 2009 in Iran, they had predicted that if something like that took hold in the Middle East, in a country like Egypt, social media could be a game changer. They just couldn't predict when the revolt would happen and how quickly the fallout would come.
Is the use of social media sufficiently pervasive in the countries that the CIA and U.S. policymakers are interested in, such that you can find out what quote, people think, or do you find out what university-educated young people think?
You're right, and that is a problem they acknowledged. They said that's why they try to backstop this with what the local radio broadcast might be in sub-Saharan Africa, where they might not have such great internet saturation. But the director did point out that in some of those places where people can't access computers, that the SMS phenomenon, where people use their cell phones to go online and register their opinion, that is also spreading the saturation across the world. He also said, though, that could be one of the downfalls for the Open Source Center in the next generation. It's already happening in Afghanistan and Pakistan. The Taliban, Al-Qaeda, will get a network of subscribers, and they will send a message in a closed loop to just those people. Say 700 people across southern Afghanistan will get the same text message. The problem with that is then you're going to have to combine covert methods. NSA and its eavesdropping methodology will have to penetrate those networks, get that information.
I guess this is true of all kinds of open source intelligence. These analysts at the CIA must see a tremendous amount of trivial stuff, that they must read through an enormous amount of information that leads them nowhere.
That's why they call themselves the ninja librarians, trying to sift through the information and figure out what counts, what is need to know, and what you just leave by the wayside. And, you know, it's a lot like our jobs.
Kimberly Dozier, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thank you.
Kim Dozier is intelligence correspondent for the Associated Press.
Support for All Tech Considered comes from Carbonite, automatically backing up computer files for individuals and small businesses worldwide. Learn more at carbonite.com.